America is based and built on the idea that freedom includes the opportunity for prosperity. It's called the American Dream. In 1931, James Truslow Adams defined the American Dream when he said, and I quote, "Life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to the ability of achievement, regardless of social class or circumstances of both." To say the same thing another way, millions of people have come to this country and discovered that if you work hard, you will get ahead. You'll have a house, a car, and at least a little money in the bank. It's called the American Dream. What I'd like to talk to you about today is the American Nightmare, which comes after the American Dream. The American Dream is going from rags to riches. The American Nightmare is going from riches to rags. What happens when you lose your money? Perhaps the car and the house. What happens then? That's a reality. All of that, in total, may not have happened to you. Perhaps some of that has happened to you. But life is such that it consists of losses. Losses of money and possessions. So I want to talk about what the Scripture says about that. We've been going through the book of Ecclesiastes, and we've come to chapter 5. So may I invite your attention again to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Now we're going to look at the whole chapter, but I'm not going to read it all at once. I'm going to read it in piecemeal. Let's begin with the first section that begins with verse 1. Solomon says, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear, rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Be not rash in your mouth, and let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on the earth. Therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known for his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay for what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it is an error. Why should God be angry at you, excuse and destroy the works of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and in many words, there is also vanity. But fear God." As I understand this chapter, Solomon is really talking about having money or possessions and losing them. I've attempted to call this Four Ways to Lose Your Money. Isn't that an exciting sermon title? Just what you came to church to hear today, how to lose your money. Said, I don't have to have instruction about that. I'd do it without your help. Right. The question is, what do you do when it happens? So we got to walk through these various things to see what could cause you to lose money and, at the end, how to respond to that. In this first section that I just read, he's talking about a religious person. Notice he says in verse 1, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God." So at this point, he's talking about doing something religious. And he says in verse 1 that you ought to hear rather than give the sacrifice of fools. Now that's good stuff. When you go to the house of God, what you need to do is hear. And of course, embedded in that is the idea that you would learn from what you're hearing. And then he says, walk prudently. So after you hear and learn, that you apply what you've heard. But that's not really his point. He's saying, do that and do not give the sacrifice of fools, Because if you give the sacrifice of fools, you do evil. If you go to church, so to speak, we would say in our day, and you make the sacrifice of a fool, you could be in danger of committing a sin. Now, what in the world is he talking about? Well, he gives us a little more insight in the second verse when he says, "Do not be rash with your mouth." And later in the passage, he says in verse 4, "When you make a vow to God." Ah, what he's really talking about in this passage is making a foolish vow to the Lord. You go to the house of God and you, well, you're rash, he says in verse 2. And you hastily, verse 2, promise God something that the scripture would call a vow. Now, frankly, we don't talk about vows a lot. Matter of fact, the Bible doesn't talk about making a vow very often. But I submit to you that it's more common than you might think. And I say that because what we don't call it vows, what we do is we make bargains. Did you ever say, "Lord, if you do X, I will do Y? Get me out of this mess, and I promise you." Well, that's the kind of thing he's talking about. And by the way, who of us hasn't done that? Gets you nowhere, by the way. The Bible's not opposed to you doing that. It just says be careful when you do that, as we shall see. In verse 2, he says, "Let your words be few." And the idea is that you not be quick to do this, that you not be hasty and harsh in your words, that you be very, very careful about doing this, and you don't do it too quickly. He explains in verse 3, "For dreams come through much activity." And this is a little difficult to understand, but the idea is if you've had a lot of activity during the day, you're going to have a lot of dreams during the night. And in that sense, verse 3, "A fool's voice is known by many words." So at the end of verse 2, he says, "Let your words be few, because fools speak a lot." Maybe we should stop there. Dismiss the service. Have you learned anything you needed to know so far today? Let your words be few. Don't talk so much. Well, that's good advice, but that's not quite what he's talking about here. He's talking about don't be hasty, quick to make a vow to the Lord. And this becomes very clear in verse 4. "When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools." Ah, the sacrifice of fools in verse 1 is making a hasty vow that you cannot or do not pay. So he says in verse 4, "When you make a vow, don't delay to pay it. Pay what you are vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay." So he's not opposed to making a vow. He's simply saying, if you make it and don't pay it, then you could be in trouble with the Lord. That's what a fool does. So if you make it, that's fine. Just make sure you deliver. Actually, this is really based on a passage in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, Moses says, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it." Same phrase is used by Solomon. "For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be a sin to you," the idea being, if you didn't pay it. "But if you abstain from vowing, it shall not be a sin to you." Get the drift? If you don't make the vow, that's no big deal. You're allowed. But if you make it, you make sure you deliver. He says, "That which was gone from your lips, you shall keep and perform. For you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God, and what you promised with your mouth." So Moses is saying, look, you can make a voluntary vow if you wish. I'm not sure I like the word bargain, but if you want to make a vow, that's okay. Just make sure you pay it. Because if you don't, then you have sinned. Now I go back to Ecclesiastes and we get the real drift. He says in verse 6, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. In other words, he's saying, don't make the vow and then have to go to the priest, in the case of the Old Testament, and say, whoops, I made a mistake. That was an error. I shouldn't have done that. Can I get out of this? And Solomon says, no, you can't. Look at the verse 6. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, this also is vanity, but fear God. Wow. The real key to this first little subsection is right in the middle of verse 6. Why should God be angry? Then he says, and destroy all your works. And that's why I said what this passage is really talking about is how to lose your money. So let me give you the first way you can lose your money. Make a vow and don't pay it. Then you've got a problem with God. Now, if you don't make the vow, that's fine. It's voluntary. You don't have to do it. But if you do it, make sure you pay it. I said it a moment ago, I'm not sure that the Bible talks about vows very much. I am sure about that. I'm not sure we talk a lot about it. But there are vows. Lots of bargains. I get skittish about that. But I think one of the most famous vows in all of history that I know anything about came from a fellow named Martin. His father wanted him to go into law. So he went to the university, actually got a master's degree. And after he graduated, he was walking across the countryside in a thunderstorm and got terrified. And made a vow that if the Lord would spare his life, he would become a monk. He lived. And he paid the vow. Within 2 weeks, Martin Luther became a monk. Now, that's what Moses is saying, and that's what Solomon is saying. If you're going to make a vow, it's all voluntary, you don't have to do it. But if you make one, just make sure you fill it, and make sure you do it quickly. 2 weeks. All right? But if you don't, you run the risk of getting God mad at you. And if God gets mad at you, well, he says in verse 6 of chapter 5, he will destroy the work of your hands. It's vanity. All that you did is vanity. Now, you've heard me say repeatedly in this book, the word vanity means breath. Or vapor. And the idea is it's transitory, it's temporary, it's useless. Matter of fact, the other phrase that he uses a lot in this book is it's chasing after the wind. If you caught it, you'd end up with nothing. So he ends this little section by saying at the end of verse 7, just fear God. Don't be quick to make a vow unless you're absolutely certain you're going to be able to pay it. So, I say, the first way you could lose all your money is make a foolish vow and get God mad at you. There's a second way, and I think you will identify with this as well. Look at verse 8. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province. Do not marvel at the matter, for high officials watch over high officials, and high officials over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. Now, it is obvious that we're no longer in the house of God. We're no longer dealing with God, as in the first 7 verses. We're now dealing with government. all levels of government. Look at what he says in verse 8. High officials or high official watches over high officials. Isn't that levels of government? And higher officials over them. Translated, in our system, you got local, state, and national government. At all levels, Solomon says, don't be surprised when you see oppression. Wow. Oppression of the poor and violent perversion of justice and righteousness. The government? The government? That's right. And I think he's piggybacking off of verse 6. The government could destroy the works of your hands. As a biblical illustration of this, in the Old Testament, Israel demanded a king. God said, this is against my better judgment, but I'm going to give it to you. Now, the first king was a pretty sad case of being a king. That was Saul. David had his problems, but he was the great king. Then we had Solomon, and Solomon died. You know what happened after Solomon died? We got Rehoboam. You know what Rehoboam did? He taxed them to death. One of the ways government oppresses people is taxes. Solomon says in verse 9, moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. That's fine, but everybody should share in this. The government shouldn't oppress you with taxes. Boy, does that give me an open door. Do you think we have a fair tax code? Boy, I got more reaction out of that than I did anything in a long time. Do you think that we pay too much taxes? Oh, good. I have an agreeable audience, all right? Let me give you a list. There's federal tax. You know about that. You pay income tax. They take it out of your check during the year, and you have to pay it. Someone has said, if you don't understand why Uncle Sam wears such a tall hat, you will when he passes it around. Then there's state income tax. Now, not all the states in our union have a state tax, but we do. As a matter of fact, if you're in the highest tax bracket in the federal system, and therefore in the state of California system, you could end up paying 50% of your income in taxes. Do you think that's fair? Or would you say that's oppression? Those who have it say it's oppression. There's more. There's sales tax. There's excise tax. That's a tax on commodities. There's a gas tax. Every time you fill up your tank, you ever looked on the pump and just noticed how much you paid was the tax to the state and the federal government, and they're supposed to be using that to fix the roads, and somehow we pay the tax and end up with potholes? Mm-hmm. Explain that to me. Matter of fact, I have actually used that as an illustration before, and gas has gone up so much, it doesn't seem like it's as significant as it used to be when tax wasn't as much. But the taxes actually haven't gone up in a long time. And back when gas wasn't as expensive, it was a huge hunk of what you were paying for gas, which is understandable if they used it for fixing roads. Now, if you can get past the federal income tax, the state income tax, the sales tax, the excise tax, the gas tax, then you got property tax, if, of course, you own a house. And that's only the beginning. There are other taxes. There's a gift tax. Did you know that if you had a lot of money, there's a limit on what you can give away? The last time I heard it was $10,000. Anything over that, you got taxed for giving it away. Did you know that? You can't even give it away without being taxed. Now, of course, lawyers have a ways. And then, if you manage to make it through all those taxes and die, guess what they're going to hit you with next? It depends on how much money you got, but if you got a lot of money, then there's something called an estate tax that's sarcastically called a death tax. So somebody has said, it's what we need is a government handout. That is, the government should take its hand out of our pockets. Amen. Let me put it another way. suppose you paid the government before you took anything out for yourself, that every paycheck, the total amount went to the government until you paid them off for the year, and then whatever you earned you could keep. How long would you have to work during the year before you had paid off your tax debt? This year, it's April 21st. So everything you make from January the 1st to April the 21st, all of it goes to the government for taxes. Then what you earn the rest of the year, you get the joy of keeping. Now, the point Solomon is making is that you can lose your money if God gets angry at you, or if the government just acts like the government. You can lose your what you work for. There's more. Go back to the passage. And let's pick it up at verse 10. He says, "He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity." Now, clearly, we've changed subjects. In the first 7 verses, we were talking about making a foolish vow. In verses 8 and 9, we're clearly talking about the government. Now, in 10 through 12, he's talking about your own personal greed. Look at verse 10. "He who loves silver," money, "won't be satisfied with silver. He who loves abundance will not be satisfied with increase." We want more and more and more. I began by talking about the American dream, that we work hard, we can get ahead, we can own a house and buy a car and have money in the bank. But I think built into the American psyche is just a little bit of materialism. And that's being kind. It's more like greed. And it's been in the American psyche from day one. This is a perfect illustration of what Solomon is saying in chapter 5, verse 10. No matter how much we have, we're not satisfied. We want more. In 1774, Lord Dumore, the royal governor of Virginia, said, and I quote, "Forever imagine the lands further off still better than those upon which they have already settled. If they had paradise, they would move on as they heard of better places further west." It started the minute we hit the shore. We wanted to go deeper inland and get more. Well, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about this greed for more. Well, there's a problem with that. For starters, it doesn't satisfy. That's the point of verse 10. But there's more. Look at verse 11. "And when goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes?" What he's saying is this. You're going to be greedy and get all this stuff. But there's no satisfaction in that. That's verse 10. And there's no safety either. Because the more you increase the money, the more friends you will attract to yourself who wants part of your money. That's what he's saying. So what profit? Now, by the way, notice, he's used vanity twice in this passage, once in verse 7, once in verse 10. And now he's used the word profit again. And these are code words in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's all vanity. What profit is there? If you amassed all this money and they increase that eats it. That's what he says in verse 11. And it gets worse. Verse 12. "The sleep of the laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much." Take a fellow that doesn't have much. He's just a laborer, just has a job, 9 to 5. And he goes home and sleeps at night. Whether he had a little to eat or a lot, whether he had a snack or a banquet that night, he sleeps. But not the one that has a lot of money. Look at verse 12. But the abundance of the rich will not permit them to sleep. One of the problems with having a lot of money is you lay awake at night worrying about it, because it can get destroyed. You can lose it. All your friends will show up, help you eat it, so you lose sleep. And what you get instead are locks on the doors and the windows. You don't sleep as well when you're worried about losing your money. Anybody identify with that? Yeah, okay. Eric Fromm, a famous psychologist, said, "Greed is a bottomless pit which exhausts the person in its endless effort to satisfy the need without ever reaching satisfaction." That's what Solomon says. Your own greed will destroy your wealth, your money. It won't satisfy. It's not safe. And all you're going to do is worry about where it goes. So, he is saying in this passage, it's another thing that could cause you to lose all of your money: God, government, and now greed. There's a fourth. Look at verse 13. "There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun: riches kept for their owner to his hurt. For these riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. And he comes from his mother's womb naked. Shall he return to go as he came? And he shall have nothing from his labor, which he hath carried away in his hand." And this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he, and who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness. He has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Whoa. This passage is a little tricky because of the translation I'm reading from. Go back to verse 13. "There is a severe evil." The word "severe" means grievous. And the word "evil" means misfortune. As a matter of fact, it's translated misfortune in verse 14. And why the translators translated it evil in verse 13 and misfortune in verse 14, I don't know. But what he's talking about in this section is a grievous disaster. That, he says, can rob you of your wealth. He says, "There is a grievous misfortune I have seen in life: riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune." And that's his point. One of the things that'll rob you of your wealth is some unforeseen disaster. So there are things like a failing stock market, a fire, a flood, and there it goes. Everything you worked for is all of a sudden gone. So he says, verse 14, "When he begets a son, there is nothing left in his hand." Meaning, if it all gets destroyed with disaster, you leave it, you don't have anything to leave to your son. So he says in verse 15, picking up on the subject of death, "You came into the world naked, and you are going to leave the world naked. You're not going to take anything with you." Isn't that the slogan? Can't take it with you? Look at verse 15. "Which he may carry away in his hand." Translated, you can't take it with you. This also, he says in verse 16, is a severe evil. And keep in mind, this is the phrase, a grievous disaster. Just exactly as he came, so will he go. So in that sense, he says in verse 16, what profit is there? He has labored for the wind. That's this phrase he's used several other times in this book. You've just chased the wind. You caught it and you ended up with nothing. You die and you leave it all behind. And if a disaster got it in the first place, you didn't even have anything to leave to your kids. That's his point. So verse 17, all his days he also eats in darkness. He has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Does that not explain life or what? Especially if you've been hit with a disaster. Cecil Rose said that he spent years exploring natural resources in Africa. And when it came time for him to die, he wrote, and I quote, "I have found much in Africa. Diamonds, gold, and land are mine. And now I must leave them all behind. Not a thing I've gained can be taken with me. I have not sought eternal treasure. Therefore, I actually have nothing at all." And that's the story of money. One enterprising pastor said concerning money, "The more we have, the more we want. The more we have, the more we spend. The more we have, the more we worry. The more we have, the more we lose. The more we have, the more we leave behind." And that sums it up. Margaret Mitchell wrote a novel to express the idea that even charitable relationships and possessions eventually vanish. Remember that novel? It was made into a very famous movie, Gone with the Wind. That's precisely what he says in verse 16. What profit has he who has labored for the wind? It was like chasing the wind. It came to nothing. How many people have amassed a fortune only to lose it? That's why I said these are ways to lose money. And one of them is just a grievous disaster. You may not know his name, but you know the company he started. His name was William C. Durant. He founded General Motors and Durant Motors. Durant Motors was established in 1921. It failed in 1933, after the Great Depression. He filed bankruptcy in 1936. At that point, he owed $914,231. That's almost $1 million. How much would that be today? He lived out the rest of his life managing a bowling alley in Flint, Michigan. Vanity of vanity, all is vanity, saith the preacher. You accumulate money only to see it disappear. It disappears when God gets angry at you, government taxes you, your own greed makes you stay up at night, and those grievous natural disasters. Now, like I said at the beginning, you may not have experienced all of this. You may not have lost everything, but you've lost. You've lost money that you thought you shouldn't have lost. Sometimes it was your own personal greed or something similar. Sometimes it was the government who took it, but we've all lost. Now, what do you do with that? As I've said before in this series on Ecclesiastes, what this book is about is jerking us into raw reality. That's one of the raw realities of life. But the issue is, how do you respond to that? And that's what he says in the few verses remaining in this chapter. Verse 18. Here is what I've seen. It is good. After all, you just said it's good. What's good? I want to hear about that. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he has toiled under the sun all the days of his life, which God hath given him, for it is his heritage, meaning his lot in life. For as every man to whom God has given riches and wealth has given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and enjoy the rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God kept him busy with the joy of his heart. Hear me. I beg you, please. Hear me. What I'm about to say is very, very, very important for your personal happiness. Look at verse 20. He will not dwell unduly on the days of his life. Stop. Part of the solution, when you have suffered tremendous losses, is don't dwell on it. Don't dwell on it. Because if you focus on that and dwell on that, it's going to make the loss worse. But that's what people do, isn't it? Well, what should you do? Well, just look at the passage. Here's the good and fitting thing, verse 18. Eat and drink and enjoy the good of all your labor, which you have under the sun all the days of your life. Notice, which God gives him. Here's the option. You can look at all the disaster in your life, or you can say, you know, God's given me a gift. He's given me the gift of life. That's verse 18. He's given me the ability to work in this life. Work, the ability to work is a gift of God. So you can look at all the doom and gloom, or you can look at the good gift coming from the hand of God. And if that's not enough, he says in verse 19, now keep in mind he says eat and drink in verse 18. Verse 19, for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it. Let me tell you, I've mentioned this in this series before, it is a gift of God that you can eat and keep it down. That's what he says in that verse. To receive his heritage and rejoice in all of his labor. This is the gift of God. The gift of life. The gift of labor. The gift to be able to eat. The gift, I assume, he means of health. So don't focus on the bad stuff. Don't focus on the past. And don't focus on the future. Enjoy today. Enjoy life. Enjoy it as a gift from God. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your food. And as he says elsewhere in the book, and enjoy your relationships. There was a psychologist who lived a number of years ago named William Moulton Marsden. He asked 3,000 individuals, "What have you to live for?" 94% were not living at all, according to him. They were doing the present, waiting for something in the future. They were waiting for something to happen, such as waiting for their children to grow up and leave home, waiting for the next year when things would be better, or at least different, waiting for a chance to take a trip, waiting for tomorrow. Now you need to make some plans for the future. That's perfectly appropriate. But what Solomon is saying is don't focus on the days of your life, past or future. Focus on today. This is the day the Lord hath made. And I will rejoice and be glad in it. I've got today. I don't know what I'm going to have tomorrow. I've got today. So I'm going to rejoice and be glad in it. I know I just lost. Whippy-doo. Now you don't have it to worry about. So rejoice. Now let me sum all this up and make a suggestion. I think what he's teaching in this passage is that even though there can be futility in having money, in that you lose it, people can enjoy the common activities of life because it is a gift from God. It's not money that makes you happy, you know that. One ancient author said, money has never made anyone rich. You have to think about that, but it's true. Here's my suggestion. You have a choice. You have a choice. Especially when you lose everything. You have a choice. Or when you lose a lot. Or when you lose a little. You have a choice. If this passage teaches anything, it teaches that. You get down to the end, and he says, you know, don't dwell on the days of your life unduly. Don't do that. But that's what we do, aren't we? We look at all that we've lost, or the fact that we have no prospects for the future. And we get depressed. We complain. We gripe. We play victim. We focus on the futility of life and wallow in self-pity. One pastor said, and I'm going to quote him, "You and I constantly bump up against people submerged in self-pity. They are hopelessly lost in the swamp of life. And all they can tell you is how wrong this was, or how unfair she was, or how someone's promise was broken, or how the man walked away and left me and the kids. And this guy broke up a partnership and took me to the cleaners," and on and on and on. That's one option. You can play victim, and you can wally in the swamp of self-pity. I love it. Or you have another option. You can rejoice. You can rejoice in the good gifts of God, which are right in front of your face. He's given you life. He's given you things to do. He's given you health. You can eat and enjoy food. And he's given you relationships. When I was in college, I had a professor named Mrs. Green. She's a small little thing, but that was a big package. She was a tough teacher, taught speech, but a very gracious Christian lady. And she made us recite over and over again a psalm. It's so embedded in my brain, I can never forget it. "This is the day the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." Now, those are your two options. You can have a pity party, or you can say, "This is the day the Lord hath made. I'm going to rejoice and be glad in it." That's it. Those are your options. A lady named Linda wrote, "Civilization is a stream with banks. The stream is sometimes filled with blood, killing, stealing, shooting, and doing things historians usually record. While on the banks, unnoticed, people build houses, make love, raise children, sing songs, write poetry, and even whittle statues. The story of civilization is the story of what happens on the banks. Historians and journalists are pessimists because they ignore the banks. The stream is filled with disaster. The banks are where ordinary life takes place. Now you can either float down the stream or camp on the bank. So what I'm after today is a little bit of an attitude adjustment. That when there's a loss, even a big loss, grieve, that's legit, but don't stay there. Don't unduly dwell there. At some point, you have to decide, I'm going to rejoice. I am going to enjoy this day. I don't remember who. It's one of those few things I didn't write down. As you know, things happen and I write them down to use them as sermon illustrations. I didn't write this one down, as I recall. But I remember, I think it was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I talked to a very wealthy man who had lost everything. He had to file for bankruptcy. I think he was a businessman of some kind. What I remember that made an impression on me was this. They had $100 left. So he took his wife and went out to dinner and bought a steak. Now that's what I'm talking about. He went to work the next day, got a job, started all over. But I'm not going to be defeated by this. I'm going to go enjoy a good steak tonight. Some time ago, I read a story, and it just so puts this down where it needs to be put. What we need to do is adopt this kind of an attitude. Remember Candace Bergen? Remember her? What you might not know is she had a little daughter named Chloe. According to her, Chloe was a, quote, stellar human being. Candace said she tended to be pessimistic. Chloe had a positive attitude about everything. In order to illustrate that, Candace told this story, and I'm going to read it as she wrote it. She said that her mother lived in a spotless house with immaculate ivory carpet. Chloe, then 11, they went over to the mother's house for a visit, and Chloe, she was 11 years old at the time, came bounding into the living room clutching a huge glass of cranberry juice. Candace said, before we could suggest white grape juice as an alternative, she plopped on the sofa and accidentally spilled the full glass of red liquid onto the brand new peach silk upholstery. For a second, we froze. My mother had not yet come into the room, and although she loved Chloe, and her love was boundless, this might have pushed the envelope. Then as one, we sprang into action. Soda water, damp sponges, paper towels, frantic mopping, blotting, futile blowing, the sound of approaching footsteps, and Chloe flipped the large cushion over, sinking quickly into it, and announced, grinning, so that no one in particular was addressed the word, she said, life is good. My advice to you is, flip the cushion. Don't look on the spill, look on the side that isn't damaged yet. Let's pray. Father, thank you for life, for all the good things you've given us in it. Thank you for the rain. We take that as a good gift from your hand. But Lord, what we need is an attitude adjustment, that we not look on the sad side of life, but that we make up our minds that we're going to rejoice, that we're going to enjoy life, regardless of what life may bring. Teach us this truth, I pray, in Jesus' name, amen.